following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
You're listening to the FlyPod New Media Network. I'm your show host, Gary Puckett, and as always, we're coming to you exclusively through the magic of our digital program feeds on theflypod.com. We podcast local and national shows daily to thousands of small communities across the United States, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. Our operations are growing at a phenomenal rate. Some weeks are absolutely crazy, but it's a good kind of crazy, I can assure you. Let the FlyPod be your source for local world time-shifted digital media podcasts. My guest on today's show is Jack Renninger. He is 88 years of age and a veteran of World War II, but more specifically, he is a survivor of the two-hour air attack on Pearl Harbor, which took place, of course, on December 7th, 1941, when the Japanese staged a sneak attack from the air on our U.S. naval fleet and airfields at Oahu in the Hawaiian Islands, resulting in a full-scale war involvement by the United States. In fact, the United States declared war on Japan the very next day, December 8th. Aside from his service in the U.S. Navy, he is also a retired police chief of a small Midwestern town, having completed 30 years of public service. He's one of those good citizens. That's what I would call him. Jack, it's a pleasure to have you on my show.
Thank you, Gary. It's a pleasure to be here.
After the Great Depression hit, there was very little work, and I'm told that in the 1930s, you worked with a job crew which was part of the 3C organization, which stood for the Civilian Conservation Corps. Now, this was a government-funded nationwide, let's call it a back-to-work program, really, intended to get the American economy moving again. During that time with the Corps, what kind of work did you do day-to-day, Jack?
Well, I enlisted in 1937, in the fall, or in the spring of 1937, and I went out to Montana, and I worked on an irrigation project out in Montana. We channeled water out of the Yellowstone River onto the grounds in that area, and where they raised a lot of sugar beets. And there was an area from Pompey Pillow, Montana, to about 10 miles down the line. And that this was an irrigated area, and we worked on that irrigation project.
The irrigation to bring water, drinking water, to areas or for farming purposes?
Bring water into the area for farming purposes.
Okay. So where were you based out of with the 3C organization?
I was based at Ballantyne, B-A-L-L-A-N-T-I-N-E, Ballantyne, Montana, which would have been 30 or 40 mile east of Billings, Montana, which is one of your major cities there.
Is that the Missoula area at all? Is Missoula?
Missoula was our headquarters for the 3C was at Missoula. They had an army post there at Missoula, an infantry post.
Okay, so the headquarters were Missoula.
That's right.
I see. Now, you're a pretty big fella, and I would guess that in your youth you stood a bit over 6 feet tall. For a guy to be over 6 feet tall in the 1930s, that was a little unusual. I mean, in general, people were slightly smaller then.
Yes.
Did that work for you or against you?
Well, I think it worked for me. I was 6 foot five and weighed about 200, well, I weighed about 170 pounds then. But I was about 6 foot five. And when Germany was invaded Poland in 39, I felt we were going to be at war. And I started checking out, and I found out that at that time, 6 foot two was the limit for the Marine Corps and the Navy. So I went up to join the Army at Fort Missoula, Montana. I was going to join at Billings and go to Fort Missoula, which was an infantry post. And I went up to Billings, Montana one day, and the recruiter had a sign on the door, said be out of town at Miles City, would be back next week. So the next week, in the meantime, an article came out in the Billings Gazette, the paper that we got in our camp area, that said the recruiter for the Marines would be in Billings the next week, and he would be recruiting for the Marine Corps. And he'd be in a Navy recruiter's office for a period of about 6 weeks, and back to Seattle he would go. So when this article came out in the paper, knowing that I was too tall for the Marines and the Navy, I had some recruits in the camp that wanted to join the Marines, and I was qualified and licensed to drive this Army truck that we had in 3G camp. So I took a bunch of three or four of the fellows to Billings, Montana, to join the Marines. And when I walked out into the recruiter's office, the Marine immediately said, "There's one guy we don't want to turn down." They saw the stripes on my arms. And I said, "Well, I can't join the Marines. I'm too tall. I'm 6'5". He said, "We'll get a waiver on your height. In the meantime, you know, Germany had already invaded Poland." He said, "Well, we'll get a waiver on your height." And I could see they were starting to grab. So I said, "Well, I was on my way to join the infantry at Fort Missoula, but I said, I'll take the Marine Corps." 19-year-old kid at the time, and you know how it is. So I got on the scales, and he was weighing me. And the Navy recruiter, we were in his office, of course. A Marine was part of the Navy, and they was only going to be there temporarily. So the Navy recruiter looked at me, I'm sorry, looked at me and said, "We'll get a waiver on your height if you want to join the Navy." I can tell you his name to this day. His name was Corneliuson. He was a chief electrician's mate. I said, "Well, listen," I said, "in the Navy," I said, "in the Marine Corps and in the Army, you joined up, you got $21 a month as a buck private. Then, as I understood it, you made $24 after a while, and that was it. You didn't know then on what you were going to get. But in the Navy, you made $21 the first 3-4 months, I believe it was. And then you automatically became Seaman Second and made $56 a month."
So the Navy looked pretty attractive to you.
Pay-wise, it did.
Yeah, surely. And at that time when jobs were so scarce, income was needed. But I want to just backtrack a little bit, and I bring up your physical stature, because with a little research, I've learned that you were a 1939 Golden Gloves boxing finalist. Tell me about your experience with boxing and the Golden Gloves involvement.
Well, in Montana, I was on a 3C team, and I went and fought in the Golden Gloves.
In what weight class?
Well, I was a light heavy, but I fought heavy lots of times, because a light heavy is limited. I'm 175, and over that, you're a heavyweight. Well, you can go over your weight, but you can't go under it, naturally. So I got up to around 175, 176 pounds, and I like to go and fight the heavies. I fought the light heavies, too. And so I fought at Great Falls, Montana, is where I won the championship for Southern Montana and the championship for Western Montana. It was divided up in the state, by the state. Then I was runner-up for the state of Montana. The guy I fought in the state of for the state of Montana championship was named John Matovich. He won the state championship. He went to California and knocked out the California champion in the second round.
And the rest is history, as they say.
he was a tough cookie.
Pretty tough one. Let me ask you this, Jack. So you end up in the Navy, and to move ahead on a little bit of this, what ship were you assigned to, and what type of ship was it?
Well, I went through boot camp at San Diego. I put in, we could request a ship. I requested a destroyer, but they put me on the Vestal. They assigned me to the Vestal. That was a repair ship, one of the older repair ships that you should send up pretty well to the front. Our biggest danger of a night was air raids. They'd come in and we'd have air raids.
Because in yourself, on that ship, you were pretty unprotected, correct?
Oh, that's right. And another thing is, when the Navy chief examined me, he said, "You'll never have to go to the service." I said, "Why?" He says, "You got that bad scar on your chin bone." He says, "And Leggins will rub that raw on my left leg here. I can show it to you."
What was the scar from? I'm just curious.
Well, I was coming down the hill on State Road in a wagon when I was a kid, and I turned over in the gravel and slid in it.
So a childhood injury.
And they had to take spots off my hip and put down there a skin graft.
Okay. I didn't mean to get you off story, but go ahead.
That's right. So anyhow, he said, you'll never have to go to service. And I was pretty well dejected because we'd been at war for a week now. And I knew that we was going to be in it. Germany had invaded Poland, and it was just a week. It had been going on about a week, and I knew we would be in it eventually. So when he saw how dejected I was, he said, well, he says, the only thing I can tell you, he says, off the record, if you want to pay your own way to Salt Lake City, Utah, that's the receiving area for the western part of the country. They take them through there in big numbers. You might be able to slip through. So I said, well, that's good enough for me. So I went back to camp, got my nickels and dimes together. In about a week, I got a leave from camp and headed for Salt Lake City. I got down there, and sure enough, I got through. And every day we would drill with Ligerns on. But every day I would get up before the chief come in, who was in charge of the drilling part of it. I don't remember his name now. I would get up and I'd put a bandage around my knee, shin bone. I'd put a handkerchief around my shin bone, put my Ligerns on, and I was pretty well protected, and they never seen it. Well, I got by real bad good during the war up until about the middle of the war. One night, I fought every night. Just about I worked out every night. I had with a hospital corpsman. This was my lucky streak. He was a big guy. He'd come down and work out with me. And when I busted this here open, I told him, I said, don't you report that to the sick bay. You bring yourself a drug down here in my shop, we'll doctor it from here. So there's no record of me of ever having this
injured year. Death.
Yeah.
Eventually, what was your ultimate rank in the Navy?
Well, my ultimate rank it was first class petty officer. I made first class. But when I went back in reserves, I wound up made chief, then I made senior chief. I was about due for chief when I came out in 45. I came out, I had malaria so bad. A couple of times they had to haul me home because malaria was taking over.
Well, on your ship, the Vestal, this being a maintenance-oriented vessel, what were your primary duties on that ship?
I was a molder. And it was heavy work, and I got into that. I liked it because it could keep me in shape. And I liked to box, and that was a heavy work. And we worked with sand, and we worked with these casts. And in fact, that's what I went run into one night when we had this air raid, when I busted my shin, because we couldn't have any lights lit up with the air raid going on. We had little red lights down inside the ship, which you couldn't see from here, that door over there.
Well, let me ask you this, Jack, and I want you to just think back and give me your best recollection of this. On December 7th, 1941, at 7:55 in the morning, Oahu time, the Japanese began their attack on Pearl Harbor. Now, historic accounts indicate the attack lasted just under 2 hours. Where were you when that attack began?
Okay, I was one deck down, and when it passed the word, boats had made passed the word, all hands to quarters. We never had quarters on Sunday. That's where you fall in to get your plan of the day, the order. So that was the first time I ever ran up the ladder to my quarter station around the side, because the Arizona's band was already lined up on the Arizona. And when he said all hands to quarters, he said it in such a way that I knew there was something up.
In his voice, you could hear it.
The boatswain mate.
Yeah. Something was unusual about that command.
Oh, something very, very, very urgent. And when I got to the top and come out on the deck, a row of shells, I was straddled by a row of tracer shells. Now, if you know anything about shells, you know if you can see this tracer shell and this tracer shell, you know there's a row of shells here that you haven't seen. You say, well, what happened to you? But when I seen that row, that those red tracer shells bounce, skip off the deck like you skip a rock off the water. You've done that when you was a kid, I imagine. When that happened, I looked up and seen his plane. And he had come down, and he had a red ball on the right wing. I knew then we were attacked by the Japanese.
Now, the Vestal, your ship, you guys were tied off to the Arizona.
Right.
Now, in the grand scheme of things, target-wise, How would you characterize the Arizona and your ship? Was it right in the mix of it all?
I would say we were as close to the ground zero as any ship in the harbor, including the Arizona. We saved a few guys off the Arizona. We had a line that running over to their ship, and some of those guys, their hands were blistered, and they had to come across hand over hand.
They just shimmied their way over.
Yeah. Could you imagine how a guy would feel with hands blistered and burned and coming hand over hand, knowing that if he turned loose, the oil down there on the water is on fire, and that's going to be the end of him.
I guess we do strange things when it's life or death.
Yes, you do.
So did your ship sink? I mean, you were tied off to the Arizona. The Arizona obviously sunk. What unfolded there? How did you save your ship, or did you save your ship?
Well, our captain, when the Arizona got hit, we took two bomb hits. We took one back after where I was at and one up forward. And I can look in the eye and tell you that I was within less than nine feet, three steps from a bomb that missed me. I was up forward here, and I stepped back three steps so I could look through the hatch and get a better view of the planes going over it because the hatch was open. As I stepped back, she came through a bomb right where I was standing. You say, well, why didn't it kill a bunch of you? It was an armor-piercing shell, and she went down through about three decks before it exploded.
Wow.
She blew a hole out the bottom of the ship, and we had one up forward. But up forward, we had a lot of supplies like steel and stuff stored, and she blew up in that area up there. She didn't go through the ship, but where I was at, she went completely through the ship.
So with a hole in the bottom, you guys started taking water right away.
Oh, definitely.
Now, the Arizona, as it went down being tied off, what was your captain's response?
Our captain, who had blown over the side when the Arizona got hit, swam back to the ship and gave orders to beach our ship. As the Arizona was sinking, we were going down.
Now, this was Captain
Cajun Young.
Young, correct. Okay, go ahead.
Captain Cajun Young. And Joe George, a boatswain mate, so I was told, I didn't see Joe George. I know George George real well. He was an ex-pug from out of Georgia. And I was told that he was the one that used the far axe to cut the line. Because remember, I was aboard ship down the second deck. So Joe George cut the line with the far axe. And we got a tug, I understand, we got a tug underway. And I don't know whether we got any steam up or not. Everything happens so fast, you can't say you've seen everything.
Bet.
And this tug helped get us over in the water where we went down at. When we went down and sank there, we were still on shallow water. We were in shallow water.
To your knowledge, was there ever any real advanced knowledge or information that indicated that this might happen in Pearl Harbor?
Not Pearl Harbor. I'm going to tell you something. We had air raid drills every Sunday night. One night, I had a dream, probably maybe a week before the war, maybe 2 weeks before the war. I don't remember the exact time. I had a dream. Ship was going on fire. Guys were diving over the side on fire. Smoke was coming up. I dreamt I seen Pearl Harbor a week or 2 weeks before it happened. Now, you can believe that or not. I'll take a polygraph test if you want to pay the expert to test me on that.
Interesting experience.
Huh?
That's an interesting experience.
Well, I think I try to reason things out. I got to rethinking later on about it. I got to thinking, well, having those air raid drills every night and going to bed and thinking about it, you know.
In a real situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thinking about it. And finally, it's just embedded in your mind to the point where you just dream about it.
So as the Arizona went down, your boatsman took, with orders, a fire axe and broke your ties, and then you were pulled away from there.
By a tug, and I think our ship got some steam up, too. I'm not sure about that part.
But with the hole in the bottom, you guys, you sunk eventually.
Oh, right? Yeah. There's no question about it. We were going down. I would have been trapped there, like a lot of guys on the Oklahoma was trapped, and they couldn't even get to them.
Well, I'd like to just offer up these statistics related to the attack on Pearl Harbor. The Japanese attack sank or disabled 19 ships. including all 8 battleships, 3 light cruisers, 3 destroyers, and several support vessels. Then at the airfields, 164 planes were destroyed, 128 were damaged. Among American sailors, Marines, and soldiers, 2,335 were killed, along with 68 civilians, and 1,178 persons were wounded. Now, I have this question for you, Jack. In life, you're 88 years old, and you are just in amazing condition and your overall person. You're alert, you're with it, you seem to me to be a very healthy 88. I have to ask you this. Do you feel like you're a pretty lucky guy, or are you just a thankful guy in life?
I feel like I'm very, very lucky. Very lucky.
You experienced a lot of hell.
Yeah.
And you came through the other side. Was there a bit of the survival instinct that just kicks in more in some people that allowed you to survive in some of these situations, or was it just pure luck?
I just consider it luck, because when I stepped back from that plane going to see if I could get a better view of the plane, the hatch opened, and the bomb came through where I was standing. And I'm going to tell you about I got to explain it to you about those tracer shells. When I first got out of the, stepped out of the hatch onto the main deck, responding to the call for our hands, of course, when I seen those tracer shells, and later on, after things had died down, I went back and seen, I knew that with tracer shells here and tracer shells there, there has to be a row of shells through here. I couldn't figure out why my legs wouldn't cut up. I went back and I found out why. Now, if you know anything about the Navy, a bollard is a round steel post. Well, I guess it's that big around, maybe that high. They use that to put
tie
your
off.
Line around,
yeah.
Tie up.
So maybe 18 inches in diameter and maybe a...
No more about yeah. that, yeah.
And a foot and a half tall.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, you got a good picture of it. Now, I got back and looked at this was later on in the day to see why my legs wouldn't cut up. There was a row of indentations in that there steel bollards. I just happened for a minute second to be running behind. It wasn't nothing to hide behind because hell is only about that high.
Right.
But I just happened to be running behind that when that plane strafed that thing. And there on the steel bollard was a row of indentations.
My goodness.
To me, that was a row of shells had it hit that and I was just running behind it.
Could have very easily been your legs.
Yeah.
Well, will you describe what you recall seeing and smelling and experiencing during that tragic 2 hours? I mean, it had to have been utter chaos, but as you looked around, what were you seeing?
Well, I thought, and maybe it sounds like I'm boasting, but I thought I was seeing men who were well-disciplined. I consider ourselves pro. We weren't draftees. I considered ourselves, because the draft didn't start until over a year later, you know.
You were there because you wanted to be there.
Yeah, right. So I felt these guys were all pros, and I felt I was proud of them, the way they handled themselves. I did not see a man that I can recall who showed any sign... Of course, I'm not going to say, hey, I wasn't scared. You know damn good and well you don't want to die at 21 years of age. But it's something that you keep inside of you. I say a man is scared and goes ahead and does his duty. He's a damn brave man, because if you're not a scared and doing your duty, don't take any nerve to do that. But when you're scared and you go out and do something and you know that you could be killed, but you're scared, you're still doing your job, that takes nerve.
How did your wartime experiences change you personally?
I believe that you have more regard for life. I think that it makes you realize how short life can be.
How fragile it is?
How fragile it is. And you mentioned about my alertness and my apparent sake of good health. I always took care of myself. I've never smoked over 3 cigarettes in my life. On December the 7th, 1941, I took about 3 puffs off of a cigarette. I thought, hell, if I'm going to go, I may as well have a smoke. That was my feeling.
Sure.
And I took about 3 puffs off that cigarette. Someone else furnished it. And during that week or the next 10 days maybe, I probably had maybe two or three cigarettes. I always took care of myself. I always run. In fact, here, I've got six broken vertebrae in my back now. I used to go down, walk down here. It's about 3 miles my driveway and up the road that way, 3.5 miles. Then my wife would come down and get me. So I did this up until about 3 years ago. But I don't mind telling you that since I hurt my back, I don't do much in the way of exercising.
What limits you? Well, have you ever gone back to Pearl Harbor to visit?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. When I went back, when we had our Pearl Harbor Survivors reunion over there, this fellow that was influenced by me to join the reserves, why, he asked me if I would speak to his unit. And I said, sure, it was on Saturday when things was kind of slow for the reunion. And I went down here, took me in, and he said, made sure that our cameras was locked up at the bottom of the car. I thought, uh-oh. And we went in, and he introduced me to his captain. And they were about, oh, maybe 15 or 20 or 25 of those fellows. Just, boy, they were sharp and smart. And he introduced me, didn't tell me what they were, and had me to give him a speech. And when I got done, I got the cap in there. It was a Central Pacific Intelligence Agency.
I'll be darned.
So,
As you reflect on your life, what does it mean to you to be an American?
I think we're the most fortunate people in the world to be an American. To give you an example, that book I have, I came from a family of 13. Never had over, I don't recall over ever four of us being at home one time. We left home early. My oldest brother was Cass. His picture's in that book right over there. He joined the Marines, fought in Haiti when he was 15 years old. In Haiti in 1919, if you study your history and read up, you find out that it was a bloody, bloody mess. They would kill the Marines and take and eat the Marines' heart. Because they felt the bravery from the Marines, you see how brave the Marines were, that would be transferred to their body. So that was my oldest brother, Cass, at 15. My youngest brother, Harry, Buddy, he's in World War II, and I was riding home telling him we was going to be in war. And he joined at 15 years old, and he was in the Great Lakes when the war started. And another buddy, he was only 16, come up to him, let's tell him how old he was. He always said, hell no. So the other guy did and got out. He stayed in, and he come over, and I got him transferred to my ship. We pulled a couple of years together. So my oldest brother, 15, fought in Haiti as a Marine, as a rifleman. My youngest brother fought in the Navy. And my son, who lives up the road here, Jack, he liked to worry us to death. He was going to Miami University, and when the Vietnamese War came up, he left the university to join the Navy. He said, well, Navy in Vietnam wasn't too bad. He had a good job there at Norfolk. He asked for a transfer to Vietnam. He got over there on board ship. Then he asked for a transfer to the beach. He was in the support group with the Marine Corps. Now, I'm going to tell you this here, and you can believe it or not, and of course, you only pull about a year, then they kicked him out of there, you know. His year, what did he do there? It was a support group for the Marines. He drove ammunition up the highway with sandbags on the bottom of the truck. Now, you know and I know, a truck with the sandbags on the bottom, if he runs over a landmine loaded with ammunition, he's going up. There's no question about it. They'd have a helicopter flying escort. These guys were laid back in the bush and lobbed these shells at him. So his year was up, and then he enlisted for another year over there. 2 years was up. And his third year hit. That second year was up, then he took his third year. And my oldest brother, 15, in World Haiti, youngest brother, 15, in World War II. My son over there in Vietnam on the beach for 2.5 years.
Service runs in the family.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have one final question for you. If you had some words of wisdom to whisper into the attentive ear of a young person, what would you say to them?
Well, I talk to them all the time in these schools, and I would say to them, be patriotic, be willing to serve your country, and learn about conditions throughout the world, and be able to vote intelligently, not on what some politician can tell you in order to get his vote, get your vote. Know what who you feel is well-qualified, and your patriotism, and if we maintain those values, we'll be a free country for a long, long time.
Excellent. Jack, I want to thank you for taking time to come on my show today. You are truly a member of a bold and courageous generation of Americans, and as a fellow American, I would simply say to you, thank you for your service.
Well, I appreciate that.
And good luck to you, and I wish you continued good health. You look great. 88 years of age, I can hardly believe it. And if I may, at this time, reach across the table and just shake your hand here.
Glad to shake your hand.
Congratulations, and thank you very much for your service. Well, that is my show for today. And not to embarrass my guest, but it's always been a pleasure to bring a true American hero on our show. Individuals who have served well their country and their community. Jack Renninger is just such a person. He has lived a life well spent. I encourage each and every listener of today's show to pass it on and share it with a friend or family member so they can experience what we have heard here today. Again, I'm your host, Gary Puckett, and you're listening to The Flypod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com. Thanks again for listening.